It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The World Encyclopedia of Serial Killers is the most comprehensive set of its kind in the history of true crime publishing. Written and compiled by Susan Hall, the four-volume set has more than 1,600 entries of male and female serial killers from around the world. Defined by the FBI as a person who murders three or more people over a period of time, with a hiatus of weeks or months between murders, serial killers have walked among us from the dawn of time, as these books will demonstrate. While the entries to these volumes will continue to grow, the FBI estimates that there are at least 50 serial killers operating in the United States at any given time. The World Encyclopedia of Serial Killers is as complete as possible through the end of 2017. In June 2020, the set begins with Volume 1, Letters A to D. The entries include Ted Bundy, the Candyman Dean Corll, Angel of Death killer Donald Harvey, the ABC killer, and the Bodies in the Barrel murders, among many others. You will find these killers and approximately 500 others in this first book in the series of the World Encyclopedia of Serial Killers, Volume 1, A to D, with my special guest, journalist and author, Susan Hall. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Susan Hall.
Thank you for asking. I'm pleased to be part of your show.
Thank you so much for joining me. Let me start with how you came to want to write this, compile and write this encyclopedia, the World Encyclopedia of Serial Killers. How did you come to this project?
Okay, it started out just as a hobby of mine. Way back in the early 1970s, I heard about a killer in Michigan who was killing co-eds at Eastern Michigan University and the University of Michigan. And a book was finally put out called The Michigan Murders. And this was a young man named John Norman Collins who killed seven co-eds up there. And his uncle, who was a state highway patrolman, was instrumental in his capture.
Now, tell us how you put this together. What was your criteria? Because there are a lot of serial killers in here that I have not read about before, and I've read various compilations. So tell us the process that you undertook to be able to compile and write this encyclopedia.
Well, in the beginning, Dan, it was just for my own information. It started out as a hobby of mine, and I realized I had, you know, all of these sheets and sheets and sheets of paper because I printed it all out that I was keeping in a book. And I started compiling it into some sort of a book. And I thought, you know what? Other people write encyclopedias, and they have 150 or 176, which I have both of them here on my desk. And I thought, I don't know how many I've got, but I've got a lot more than that. So my husband and I discussed it, and we decided that I would put it in book form, and if I could get someone to publish it, that was fine. Otherwise, I had a nice book for myself.
Fantastic. And tell us about the plans for the other volumes that we just alluded to in the introduction.
The volume 2, E through L, is going to be available, I believe the date is August the 24th. Book 3 and 4 do not have a published date yet, but my guess would be October and December.
Interesting. Before we start providing some really dramatic examples of some of the serial killers that I had not heard of, and you have a fair amount of detail about some of these serial killers, were there any surprises in this putting this book together? Even though you have been a big fan of serial killers and true crime for many years, were there any real dramatic surprises in putting this together?
Probably the biggest was how many killers there were all over the world. I thought it was, you know, more or less just a U.S. thing. I hadn't heard of any. But as I got to investigating, I found more and more and more.
You said,
you know, I went to libraries. I searched the internet endlessly. There's all kind of lists out there of serial killers. You can get serial killers by country, you know, just endless. When I was almost finished so that I could turn the book over to the publisher, a new list came out with over 200 new serial killers all in Russia. And I asked and was granted an extension because I felt they had to be in the book.
Certainly, certainly. Now let's go to some incredible examples. And one of the entries in there, right in the letter A and near the beginning of the book, is Wolfgang Abel. And you say he was born in 1959 and born in Dusseldorf, West Germany. And his partner, Furlan, Mario Furlan, he was born in 1960 and born in Padua, Italy. And you say they began their murders in August 1977 in Italy. Tell us how they started, and tell us a little bit about the characteristics of their crimes and some of the crimes that they committed in this.
Some of them were
serial killing
crimes. The very first one that I know about, they burned alive a gypsy who was also a drug addict. Another, you know, they axed people to death. They stabbed people to death. It's just horrific what these killers do to people.
They crushed the skulls of two priests with a hammer, you write, in Verona, and they burned a sleeping hitchhiker to death. They murdered a homosexual priest in Trento with a nail hammered into his head, and then they hammered a chisel with a wooden cross on it into his head. And you write, at each crime scene, they left a leaflet. Tell us a little bit about this leaflet and what was it contained.
Okay. It had the name Ludwig on it over a Nazi eagle and a swastika. It had a slogan for each murder and the reasons for the killing. The victims were chosen for any reason that Abel and Furlan could come up with. It was just, you know, miscellaneous.
Yeah, the typical victims, homosexuals, prostitutes, and you say what they considered subhumans as well.
Yes. Well, like the gypsy drug addict.
Yes. How was Abel and Furlan caught? What happened?
Let me think.
Well, they were caught.
They were caught.
You're right,
they were
dousing
caught in
a
the
carpet
act,
and furniture.
Yes, with gasoline and a crowd in a discotheque. I won't even try to say the name. I don't speak French. But that was in 1984, and they were charged with 27 counts of murder between the years 1977 and 1984. They didn't go to trial for almost 2 years, and they were only found guilty of 10 murders and were sentenced to 30 years in prison, which I understand is the maximum they can get in Italy.
Now, you write, though, that they were strangely released on bail pending their appeals. So normally there has to be some grounds for those appeals before anything like releasing them on bail would be considered. What did they do once they were released on bail, though?
Well, they left the area. Abel went to a town called Mestrino, and Ferlin traveled to another town, he was recaptured in Crete using a false name, and they were both returned to Italy.
Now, you write the appeals court sentenced them each to 27 years in prison. Incredibly, in November 12, 2010, Mario Ferlin was released on probation for good behavior. And then you write that Wolfgang Abel was freed on November 4th, 2016, remarkably.
Yes. Yes, I find that remarkable.
It is remarkable, too. I know about Canadian sentencing, and you see all kinds of cases in this book. They're all about serial killers, and we'll talk about it, but there's a couple people that are such strong suspects, you include them, even though they aren't officially been convicted of being a serial killer. It was interesting how many of these convicted serial killers, convicted obviously of multiple murders, were released eventually, even despite life sentences.
I know, and I don't understand that at all. I think when you get life, it should mean that.
I do too. I think it's a slippery slope when you start exempting people with a life sentence that doesn't mean an actual life sentence, and it is strictly or incredibly, it's an incredible example when you have serial killers in Europe, and I would say potential for Canada as well too, and they do have cases of people being released despite what you would call a life sentence. So, real misnomer, this life sentence, but these people released. Let's get back to some more of these incredible serial killers that you have in this World Encyclopedia of Serial Killers. Let's talk about the Beasts of Montmartre, and I apologize for the mispronunciation, but a person named Thierry Paulin, who was born in Martinique but lived in France, and he was a homosexual, and he met eventually when he was working as a waiter at a transvestite nightclub in Paris. He met Jean Thierry Mathurin, who was 19 years old, and they became lovers. Right away in October 1984, a woman named Germaine Petitot, 91 years old, was assaulted, but they survived, but were too traumatized to give police a description. They went on to continue with terrorizing elderly people. The next victim was 83 years old, beaten and smothered.
Yeah, that was the same night.
Well, was the same night, incredibly. What was the motive? What was their motive for these crimes, and what was their haul that first night that you report?
I think that their initial purpose was robbery. Why they felt they had to kill these old women, I haven't, you know, they're defenseless.
Mm-hmm.
They beat them.
They beat them, they robbed them,
Smothered with a pillow. Altogether, I think they murdered like 8 women, or 8 more women, which made 10 altogether.
Mm-hmm. You write, they might have started off with robbery as a motive, but they seemed to enjoy themselves. Some had bags over their heads, and one was forced to drink drain cleaner. So some sadism actually involved here. And Paulin and Matherman, you write, spent their nights dancing and drinking champagne and snorting coke using the victim's cash and credit cards. You write about a second wave of murders, December 85 to June 86. 8 more elderly women were murdered. Police detectives know that it's the same person, or determine it's the same person that killed 9 in 1984.
Yes.
In late 86, you say that Paulin attacked a coke dealer with a bat, but didn't kill him. What was the sentence for that attack on that coke dealer?
He was arrested and served 1 year in jail.
Yeah, incredible. He was released. He continued the lavish lifestyle, you write, using stolen credit cards. What disease does Paulin discover he has?
He has AIDS. He found out he had AIDS.
Mm. So in November, this doesn't deter him from murdering and continuing to murder. He murders a 79-year-old woman and then attacks a woman named Berthe Filanatrieri, and she's 87 years old and left her for dead. The last victim you write is Genevieve Germont, and he strangled her 2 days later. However, you write that Filanatri, the 87-year-old, recovered on the killer's birthday. Tell us what she's able to do for police, what she's able to give police.
She gave them a very good description, and a local police inspector recognized him from her description as he was walking down the street. And he was arrested and admitted all of the murders and his relationship with Matherin.
And as a result, you write that Thierry became ill in 1988 because of the effects of AIDS, and he died in hospital in 89. But Matherin, on the other, however, was tried and convicted of the first 9 murders. And he was given, again, we just mentioned this, he was given a life sentence plus 18 years without parole. I guess 18 years without the eligibility of parole. He was paroled in January 2009.
Right.
Again, clear evidence of why on earth he was able to be released.
Yeah, I don't understand their thinking. These people cannot be rehabilitated.
No, certainly. Certainly. Now, we have another case I thought was very, very interesting as well. And we talked about James Lee Crummell from Michigan. This is a child molester and child killer. And at 8 years old, he performed a sex act on a neighborhood boy for a pocket full of pennies. And this was just an incredible, disturbing background in his youth. He quit school in grade 9 for hitting a student and knocking down the principal. And you write that he always said his mom was domineering and treated him like the little girl she always wanted. His father died at 14. At 17, he enlisted in the Army. What happened 1 year later while he was in the Army?
Well, he was molesting little boys, and he was court-martialed in the state of Missouri. He was sentenced to 10 years and sent to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas.
A military psychiatrist tested Crummell, what did they find, what did they write in their reports about Crummell?
They said that he had the emotional maturity of an 8-year-old.
His mother died when he was in...
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, I apologize. You say his mother died when he was in prison, and he was released after 4 years only.
Mm-hmm.
And then
yeah.
You write about a partner named Steve Scheimer. What did the partnership, what did they do, where did they go, and what happened in February 67 with the pair?
Okay, there was a little boy, a fourth grader, who was riding his bicycle to his best friend's home, but he never arrived there. The neighbors all got together and looked for him, but and called and got the police involved. Shortly after midnight, they found his body in a ditch about 200 yards from his home. And he had been strangled with the belt around his neck.
And so what happened as a result of that investigation? Of course, police are investigating. What happens?
Well, let's see. They left the area, Crummell and Scheimer. They moved to Wisconsin. So they continued their killings in Wisconsin. They first killed a 14-year-old boy who was hitchhiking home from football practice in a wealthy Milwaukee subdivision. Crummell picked him up, and they stopped for ice cream. And Crummell asked the boy if he wanted to go on a delivery with him. The boy agreed, and a short time later, Crummell stopped the truck and told Steve that he wanted to show him a trick. He told him to hold his hands out in front of him, and then he tied them together. He told the boy to try to get out of it, and Steve, the boy, told him that he couldn't. Crummell asked him to continue, but he still could not. He asked Crummell to untie him. Crummell then made the boy lay down on his back and then molested him. They got back in the truck and drove away. He stopped later on and molested the boy again. And he found a tree limb, and he beat the boy very severely and tossed him into a ravine. The boy did survive, and the next day he was found by neighbors. Crummell was arrested for that a couple days later.
You write that when Steve Scheimer was interviewed, he told them that Crummell had confessed to killing Frank Clausen, the fourth grader, in Arizona. So when Pima County Sheriff Detective got to Wisconsin, what happened with this Steve Scheimer's confession?
Well, Crummell denied the confession and the murder. So the Arizona Sheriff detectives went back home. Conson sentenced him to 30 years for the assault on Steve, the young boy.
Right. You write, though, that Arizona Sheriff's Department thought this guy was going to get 30 years for the Steve Scallon assault.
Right.
You know, the as close to murders you could possibly get, and the sexual assault. But Crummell was out in 5 years, you write, and then living in Southern California. However, you write that there's a lawman that enters the story named Bob Lowe. And you take it from there. He takes his job very seriously. The first day on homicide, you write that he says, "I want that Frank Clausen case of the fourth grader," doesn't he?
Yes. He said he wanted to put the guy away. He walked into the sergeant's office and told him, "I want the cloth case. It's solvable, and Crummell is dangerous." And he got the job of going after Crummell. He read the file on it, which was several inches thick, and he knew the Clausen case, you know, from beginning to end. He did manage to find Crummell, who was then living in Lido Beach, California, with a Newport Beach psychiatrist. But Crummell was calling himself Jimmy Savage at that time.
But you write that Lowe, he found Scheimer at first in Texas. And instead of, he knew where Crummell was. But his approach was to talk to everybody. Talk to family members, old friends, other victims, and psychologists. He read all the reports. He spent hundreds of hours, weekends and nights, building the case. You write, by 1982, tell us what happens in May of 82.
Okay, May of 82.
He is taken to Arizona.
For
a preliminary. But at that preliminary, you write, Steve Scheimer, what happens regarding his statements to police?
Okay, he recanted his statements to the police about Crummell's confession and said he couldn't remember. The case was dismissed and Lowe was crushed, but determined to see that Crummell pay for Frank Clausen's murder.
Right.
So Crummell, at that point, returned to California and went to a party in Costa Mesa wearing a Martian costume with silver glitter. All through the evening, he was making passes to one of the men at the party, but the guy ignored him. The host went to check on his son, and there was Crummell kneeling at the boy's bedside with black. He was wearing, shrouding him. The boy's father attacked Crummell. Others at the party joined in and beat him severely. While he was awaiting the molestation charge in Costa Mesa, there was a change in case law in Arizona that allowed Scheimer's former statements about Crummell's confession into the trial, even if Scheimer would not cooperate. But Crummell was acquitted of the charges in Costa Mesa.
Incredible.
In February of 83, Lowe got an arrest warrant, and Crummell was on his way back to Arizona. On November the 15th of 83, he was found guilty of Frank Clausen's murder and was sentenced to life. But a year later, that was overturned. His new attorneys convinced the judge that their client had received a raw deal when his original attorney failed to adequately represent him and failed to cross-examine key witnesses.
So the second trial had its problems, you write. Again, incredibly, what else happens at this second trial in terms of problems? What's missing?
Okay, they lost footprints and a handprint that had been taken at the crime scene. A key witness had died. Scheimer still wasn't cooperating, and a hair that had turned up on the clothes of Frank Clausen, on the clothes that he was wearing that night, wasn't Crummell's. So the prosecutors felt they didn't have enough evidence for a new trial and let Crummell plead out to kidnapping. He walked out of prison a year later.
So a year later, he walks out of prison. Is that the end of the story?
No. He was questioned about the other murders, murder of Jack Phillips, and the murder of Jeffrey Vargo, who was only 6 years old, and the murder of a James Trotter, age 13. A jury in Riverside found Crummell guilty of the murder of James Trotter and sentenced him to death. But they didn't get to put him to death. On May the 27th, 2012, he hanged himself in his cell using an extension cord.
Incredible. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop just for a second for some commercial sponsors. Hi, we're back with Susan Hall, the Encyclopedia, World Encyclopedia of Serial Killers. We were last talking about the incredible case of Crummell and his reign of terror.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Let's talk about another serial killer that you have featured in this book. Actually, a duo that's quite familiar with most people, Lawrence Sigmund Bittaker and Roy Lewis Norris. And these are California serial killers, their reign of terror, 1979. And you write a little bit about their background, of Lawrence Bittaker's background. I guess people have been fascinated by the sheer depravity of these people, Bittaker especially, but his background is very, very interesting. Tell us a little bit about his background, his IQ, and what happened despite that IQ and that promising future.
He was adopted shortly after his birth. It doesn't say who his parents were, but he was adopted by Mr. and Mrs. George Bittaker. Mr. Bittaker was into aircraft construction, and they moved quite a lot, Pennsylvania, Florida, Ohio, and finally in California. They found that Lawrence had an above-average IQ of 138, but he dropped out of school when he was 17. He'd been arrested several times shortly after quitting school, been arrested for car theft, leaving the scene of an accident, and resisting arrest. He was sentenced to the California Youth Authority until he was 19. A few days after he was released, he was arrested again, this time by the FBI, for violating the Interstate Motor Vehicle Theft Act, and was sentenced to 18 months, which he served at an Oklahoma prison. To his abnormal behavior, he was transferred to Missouri medical facility, but he was released there after only 6 months.
Now, where does he meet Roy Norris?
Let's see, at the California Men's Colony. It's a prison in San Luis Obispo, California.
Right. And he's released in 1978 and goes to Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So tell us more about this partnership.
Okay. I have a little bit of background on Roy Norris.
Yes.
He lived in Greeley, Colorado until he was 17, and he dropped out of school and joined the Navy. He was stationed initially in San Diego, and in 1969 he spent 4 months in Vietnam but never saw combat. He got into drugs where there was a lot of in Vietnam. Marijuana was what he really liked. It was readily available. He was arrested in November 1969 for rape and was sent back to San Diego.
You say that he he was sent to Atascadero State Hospital as a sex offender, and he spent 5 years there, but he was released. No longer a danger, he was determined. And 3 months later, though, he raped a woman, a 27-year-old. He was convicted of forcible rape and sent to the California Men's Colony, where he met Lawrence Bittaker. Yeah. And he was released. Bittaker was released in 71 and lived with his mother in Los Angeles. And Bittaker contacted Norris. And what was the plan that they concocted? What did they want to do?
And what they came up with a plan to rape and kill girls in Los Angeles and the surrounding areas. Bittaker bought a cargo van with no windows in it, but it did have a large sliding side door. They called it the Murder Mac, M-A-C-K Mac. Mm-hmm. And they spent time driving the highways to beaches and taking photos of the girls in their bikinis. They put their murder plan into action on June the 24th of 79 when they kidnapped Cindy Schaefer, a 16-year-old, near Redondo Beach. They forced Cindy into the van, duct-taped her mouth, bound her feet and legs, and Bittaker drove them to a fire road in the San Gabriel Mountains. And when they got out of sight, they both raped Cindy. And then Bittaker wrapped a wire hanger around her neck and tightened it with vice grip pliers, strangling her to death. And they left her body in a plastic shower curtain in a nearby canyon.
Yeah. And 2 weeks later, you write, they continued. Who did they pick up and what did they do?
Okay, they picked up Andrea Hall, an 18-year-old hitchhiker. And Norris was hiding in the back of the van, but she didn't know that he was there. And Bittaker talked her into getting in and offered her a drink from the cooler in the back. And as she started to get up, of course, Norris grabbed her, taped her mouth shut, and bound her arms and legs. And they raped her several times, each of them.
You talk about something particularly cruel with an ice pick. What did he do?
He stabbed her in both ears with the ice pick. And then he strangled her and threw her body over a cliff. He took Polaroid photos of her before he killed her, though.
Incredible. Then there was Jackie Gilliam, 15 years old, and Leah Lamp, 13 years old. What happens when they get them in the van?
Okay.
There's a brief moment. Yeah, there's a brief moment when there's a realization, and then what happens?
The Bittaker drove to a suburban tennis court and parked, and the girls became suspicious, and Leah tried to get out the back door, but Norris hit her over the head with a bat. After a short scuffle, the girls were bound and gagged. They were then taken to a fire road and kept alive for 2 days while Bittaker and Norris raped them and tortured them repeatedly with a wire hanger and vice grip pliers. They even made an audio recording of the rapes and the torture. Whitaker finally stabbed Gilliam in both ears with the ice pick, but she didn't die.
Wow.
Both men took turns strangling her until she died. They then turned to Leah. Whitaker strangled her while Norris hit her in the head with a sledgehammer several times, and they dropped the bodies over a cliff.
Wow. You write about September 30th, Shirley Sanders. Tell us about her abduction and what happens to her.
Well, they got her by macing her in the face and forced her into the van. She was raped by both of them, but she escaped. They put up a photo lineup for her, and she identified both Whitaker and Norris.
Incredible.
But they didn't catch them right away, because on October the 31st, they both kidnapped a 16-year-old girl named Lynette Ledford. But instead of heading for the fire road, they took turns driving while the other one raped and tortured her, and tape recorded her screams. Whitaker eventually strangled her with a wire hanger and the pliers, and they left her body on a lawn in Hermosa Beach.
You say it caused quite a stir. You say it caused quite a stir because only a few days after the arrest of who, you write in the book?
The Hillside Stranglers, Angela Buono and Kenneth Bianchi.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah, now, you write that Norris and Whitaker were charged with murder, kidnap, rape, sex perversion, and criminal conspiracy. What was the outcome at trial? What was the sentence for Lawrence Whitaker?
Okay. Whitaker was convicted of rape, torture, kidnapping, and murder, and he was sentenced to death. He was on death row at San Quentin Prison when he died of natural causes on December the 13th, 2019. Mm-hmm. Norris had testified against Whitaker and was spared a death sentence, but he was sentenced to 45 years to life with a minimum of 30 years before he was eligible for parole. He was denied parole in 2009, and he died in prison on February the 24th, 2020.
Yeah, just recently. Incredible.
Yeah.
There are a lot of Andersons in this book. The serial killers, I noted, were five serial killers. Curtis Dean Anderson, Alan Leroy Anderson, Dale R. Anderson, Joshua Julius Anderson, and Robert Leroy Anderson. Can we talk about Dale Anderson for a moment? He was born
sure.
in Ohio in 1951. And he's an ex-police jailer, so he's a guard at a jail. And
yes.
It's interesting because the famed FBI serial killer expert Robert Ressler weighs in on this. Was asked to comment on this, or did comment on this, officially or unofficially. And this is St. Clair County, Illinois, five women. Tell us a little bit about this Dale R. Anderson.
Okay, I'm having to refresh my memory just a little bit. I can't keep all of it in my head.
Mm-hmm.
There
was Audrey Cardenas, an intern, was found on the campus of Belleville Township High School in June 88. And there was another, Elizabeth West, who disappeared on her way home after appearing in a high school play at Belleville Township High School as well. And you found that, or you say that another victim was Ruth Ann Janey, whose body was found in July 79 near a creek 5 miles south of where West's body was found and had disappeared a year earlier. And then an unidentified woman between the ages of 18 to 23 who was strangled and hidden in a cornfield in September 86, and another woman named Christina Povolish, whose body was found in a weed-covered ditch in July 87. just south of Bellevue. Now, what happens is that a person named Rodney Wojtke, you are right, a mentally ill transient, what happens with the murder of Audrey Cardenas and this Rodney Wojtke?
Wojtke was convicted of Audrey's murder and sentenced to 45 years, even though there was no evidence to tie him to the murder. Ressler and other officials believe that Wojtke is not guilty. So do I.
Mm-hmm.
Not that my opinion counts, but...
mm-hmm. Now, another person named... Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say Gregory Bowman was convicted of the murders of Elizabeth West and Ruth Ann Janney and was sentenced to life. He had confessed to the murders after Sergeant Robert Miller tricked him into confessing. The deputy said that they had a jailhouse snitch tell Bowman that he would help him escape if he confessed to the murders. So he confessed, even though there was no physical evidence to connect him to the murders.
Right.
The prosecuting attorney said he was unaware of the trickery by the deputies, and that if he had known that, the case would never have gone to trial.
Yeah. You say authorities believe that all of the murders were committed by the same person, and neither Wojtke nor Bowman were organized enough to have done the murders.
Right.
And remarkably, Dale Anderson agreed with the authorities that all of the murders were done by the same person.
Yeah, but he said
he
wasn't
he's not the
killer.
Yeah. So what does Anderson offer law enforcement at one point?
Okay, he says he can unlock the mystery of... of a woman who was murdered 13 years before and stated that he had her driver's license, but he refuses to reveal where it's hidden and will not give authorities the woman's name or address. He says he knows a lot about the murder because he investigated them as a police officer, but as we know, he was never... a real police officer. He was a jail police officer. He guarded the jail. He never been a police officer.
You write that in 1989, he continues his life of crime. He's wearing a ball cap, and he's posing as a home buyer from Springfield. And then there's a house near Belleville listed for sale by a realtor. What happens when the woman shows Anderson around the house?
Well, he stopped in, you know, unannounced, and he insisted on seeing the house, and he insisted on seeing the crawl space. So the woman opened the door and leaned in as Anderson stood over here, and almost immediately a friend of the woman's walked into the kitchen, and Anderson turned and ran out the front door.
And so what does the woman or the police do as a result of this? What happens next?
Well, a week later, wearing a ball cap and carrying a bag, he stopped at another house listed for sale, but the woman wouldn't let him in. Hours later, and still wearing the ball cap and carrying the bag, prosecutors believed he again posed as a home buyer at the home of Jolaine and John Landman. John wasn't home, but Jolaine allowed Anderson to come in and showed him the house. While in the bedroom, Landman's 3-year-old son pulled something out of the bag and struck Jolaine in the head while in the bedroom. No, the son didn't do it. Anderson did it. I'm sorry. he pulled something out of the bag in the bedroom of the 3-year-old and struck Jolaine in the head. Her husband arrived sometime later, and he found his wife and son underneath the bed with a rope tied around her neck and a pair of scissors stuck in her throat. The back of his wife's and son's heads has been crushed. police tried to get in touch with Anderson, but no one would answer his telephone.
They feared for the lives of his family, you write, and so finally after 2 days, the police forced their way into his home, and they took his children out in their pajamas.
Yes.
After talking with police for several minutes, Anderson came out. What happened in the search of the house? What did police find?
Okay. Well, Anderson came out cowering behind his wife, using her as a shield. They found many weapons and hundreds of newspaper articles and other documents about the Cardenas murder. Anderson was charged with murdering the Landmans. He was convicted on 2 counts of first-degree murder of both Jolaine and the 3-year-old son, and was sentenced to life in prison without parole. He's currently at the Menard Correctional Center at Chester, Illinois.
Yeah. It is interesting, all the Andersons, again, you don't have any other names, regardless of whether they're common names, but I guess when you're dealing with Andersons, a little more common name than some of the serial killers, but how interesting is it that there are 5 serial killers named Anderson in your list?
When we get into the other volumes, there are others, Jacksons and Johnsons. Seems like there was another one. I can't think what it was. One thing that is kind of weird, how many people are named John Wayne or Wayne. There are, I think, at least 4 named John Wayne something. John Wayne Gacy, John Wayne Glover. In fact, John Wayne Glover, I think, is in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, he's in the second book. I'm sorry.
No. Yes. No, no.
I'm thinking
G,
too far ahead.
Yes, you are thinking of it. Tell us about, speaking ahead, when is the next edition, the next volume, 2, is, again, could you mention again the letters and what it includes?
Yes, that's
and,
the
when
alphabet.
It's...
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, no, I just wanted to know details of the release.
Yeah, okay. Volume 2 is E through L, and it is to be released on August the 24th.
Okay, great. Now, in this encyclopedia, you cover bluebeards, you angels of death. You talk, there's many headings of beasts, and what I found interesting, too, is because many, I think, compilations shy away from it, many instances of satanic influence and satanic groups, some with that you had were 7 or 8 accomplices that were eventually convicted in a group that considered themselves satanic.
Right. There were a few groups that did. I don't know how you get your friends and relatives to kill. I just don't understand it at all. I don't know if it's mob mentality or what.
We've said you have 500 serial killers listed in here.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The vast majority you talked about, you said that serial killing has gone, is a fairly new term. However, serial killing is as old as time itself. You have 500 killers. Where was primarily the most serial killers? Where did they exist? Where did they live and kill?
Good old USA. We have many times more than any other country. England is 2nd in number of serial killers, and they're less than 100. 79 sticks in my head, but it's less than 100. Germany is right up there. Italy is right up there. And of all places, South Africa. They have more than their share of serial killers.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that can be explained, too. We had a guest on and talk about you know, after apartheid was ended, there was a rash of serial killers and serial murder.
Oh, yes.
Especially. What was the most disturbing serial killer case that you covered in this first edition, A to D?
Oh, wow.
Well, you don't have to stick it to one. I mean, if there are a couple of examples.
Well, Bittaker and Norris were very disturbing.
Yeah.
The ones that bother me are the most, I do believe, are the serial killers who molest and kill children.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine anybody doing that.
Well, you don't have to imagine it. It happens, so.
Oh, I know it does. I know it does.
Yeah, you talk about, too, the Vega schoolgirl murders, for example. Lindsay Huani Beckett and Leslie Alfred Camilleri. Beckett's from New Zealand, and then they moved to Australia near Canberra. And there, Beckett met Leslie Camilleri. And they began to steal cars. Camilleri is interesting. You write that he had a juvenile record and detention of 146 offenses. So
yeah.
Before he started doing anything, he had a life of crime already set out for him. And in September 97, you write about an abduction in Canberra and held captive by these two men, raped repeatedly. They were in their 20s. And this person, again, and many stories in this serial killer book, incredibly, we get the information because a victim, remarkably, almost unbelievably, escapes and
yes.
is able to help identify them. And
If we have time, I have a quick story about a stupid serial killer. He was killing prostitutes. He took this prostitute out to a vacant area, got stuck in the mud. He had put the prostitute in the trunk of his car. He opened the trunk, put her behind the wheel, and he said, "I'm going to push you out." Well, he did, and of course she put it in gear and took off.
Yeah.
Went to the police, and they went back and arrested him.
Was it just one kill? One?
No,
murder,
no. He was a serial killer. He was the Acres Home. It's in that first book, Acres Home Killer.
Right. How many murders, and what were some of the characteristics of that killer?
I was trying to get to it real quick. He murdered six women between the years 2000 and 2008. He abducted prostitutes and took them out to rural areas and raped them and then murdered them.
So if it weren't for this stupid mistake, he could have certainly continued.
Oh, he would have. Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah,
but he was convicted and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Another thing I noticed in this serial killer compilation that I thought was odd is how many duos, how many, you know, male duos were involved
yes.
in the most, I think, the most heinous of serial murders. If not that
yes.
all of them are in competition with each other, but it seemed that together, they went to further lengths, it's incredible the depravity by the duos in this book. What do
yes.
you think of that?
Yes. Well, like I said earlier, how do you talk a friend into murdering somebody with you? I don't
well,
understand
at the same time,
that mentality.
At the same time, these people are meeting in prison, and they weren't meeting in prison because they didn't have violent criminal records. To be
right.
fair, right? So it's not just like you and I asking a friend, I would think. There are certainly cases where, again, foolishly, people go to people that are they think they can trust, that they are their friends, but unfortunately their friends cannot fathom what their friends are now saying to them, or what they thought were their friends saying to them, inviting them to do murders. Some of these killers, the people that they spoke to, don't really recognize at the time the seriousness of the statements. But later, when they're arrested, later when police talk to them, later they realize what these people were trying to talk them into, and they go to police, of course, because this killer totally misunderstood the relationship with their friend and told them something
yes.
that they certainly ended up regretting. Before I let you go, and it's been fascinating talking to you about the World Encyclopedia of Serial Killers, what else do you think, as a result of this project, moving ahead for the other volumes, what do you think will be one of the central themes, other than the serial killing, obviously, but what seems to be a common pattern among these killers in this first edition?
Oh, geez, that's a hard one. You know, they talk about serial killers having horrible childhoods. Not all of them did. Some of them had privileged childhood, but yet they became a serial killer. Jeffrey Dahmer had a good life.
Yeah.
Look what he did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I don't know how, you know, you go from normal to being so depraved.
Well, as you write, though, too, that a famous FBI profile, I believe John Douglas said, the serial killer is more made than born. And you include that, and I thought it was a very interesting statement.
Yes, I did, too. I read that years ago, and I thought that was very appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, there are these people who had a normal childhood, some of them a privileged childhood, and they became serial killers.
Yes.
So they weren't made serial killers, not from their childhood.
No. I want to thank you very much, Susan Hall, for coming on and talking about the World Encyclopedia of Serial Killers. I know this is Volume 1, A to D, and this is a Wild Blue Press publication. So for people that might want to take a look at this, is there an Amazon page, Wild Blue Press? Where can they go to take a look and find out about this
Amazon.
Book?
Yes, they can go to Amazon. It is available on Amazon, or they can go to wildbluepress.com, both places.
Great. And your second edition, E to L, is out mid-August. We certainly
yes.
will want to have you back and to discuss that at length. Thank you very much,
okay.
Susan Hall, The World Encyclopedia of Serial Killers, Volume 1, A to D. Thank you so much. You have a great evening, Susan Hall.
Thank you. Thanks, Dan, for asking. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Good night.